It's the UEFA Champions League on Paramount Plus. Europe's top club soccer tournament. Champions versus champions. The best teams facing off in the knockout rounds.
Magnificent!
And it all takes place
while you're filling out financial reports at work. In the middle of your day, in the middle of your week. So use that second screen. Call in sick. Do whatever you gotta do to tune in Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Nobody watches the UEFA Champions League like us. Stream every match live exclusively on Paramount Plus.
First cut. Golly!
Welcome to the First Cut Podcast. I'm Rick Gaiman, and this is your DFS preview for this week's Farmers Insurance Open. Joining me to break it all down, Sia Najad is here. Sia, hey buddy.
Could you identify my silent protest on behalf of the Buffalo Bills for the terrible overtime rules? This is the football show, right?
Yeah, we could do that. Is there a solution to the overtime rules? What's the solution?
Yes. Go, Greg.
You play a quarter.
What happens if you're still tied after a quarter?
You play another quarter.
So
you
that
just
sounds...
continue to play more quarters until the game is
could
no
make,
longer
you
tied?
You could make a rule like a you have to go for two rule in overtime along with a set amount of time. But the thing is, it's not a game like... Like in hockey, you can play sudden death, right? Everybody touches the puck.
Possession is changing constantly.
Right.
In baseball, this is the analogy I heard this morning. Michael Breed gave this analogy on SiriusXM, and he said it's like it'd be like having a baseball game where in extra innings, you only play half the inning if a team hits a home run. And the other team that you never get in that bat.
And then the defense would be like, oh, well, you should have stopped him from hitting the home run. Well, it doesn't take away from the fact that that other team should have gotten a chance to bat. And so I think Greg's rule is actually great for the playoffs. I think in the regular season, you don't want to injure the players any more than they already are or tire them out. But in the playoffs, both teams should get a possession.
Well, hold on, because that's also both teams getting obviously producer Jacob is not here. So we are off the rails immediately. I'm producing this show. We're talking with football for the moment. That's Greg Ducharme. I didn't get a chance to introduce him. Okay. But if you go for a full quarter, yes, it is likely that both teams get a possession, but it's not guaranteed. You could have a 10-minute drive, eats up the whole clock and the team kicks the field goal. That does not solve the problem necessarily.
But at that point, it's a strategy and there's more of an opportunity, right? It's a set. It's rare to see a 15-minute drive.
Right. Sure.
You could see a 10-minute drive, a 12-minute drive. I mean, that happens. But all of a sudden, do you use your timeouts? If they've been going for 11 minutes and it's getting tight, now I got to use my timeouts on defense, it becomes another fourth quarter. So it's way more likely. But I'm not a fan of college overtime either. I feel like it doesn't produce the best results.
I think college overtime is fine, but back. Like the 25-yard thing, it's too close. Move them to like midfield or something or their own 40.
Out of field goal range at least.
Yeah.
There you go. We're looking at you, Roger Goodell, with really good ideas. Please fix it. Thank you.
There you go. We just solved the problem. Now we're going to solve your DFS problems. Alert, alert. This tournament starts on Wednesday. Do not forget. Don't be the person who tweets at us at the real GFD. I thought it was a Thursday morning start. I left my dummy lineup in. Don't be that guy. This starts on Wednesday, runs through Saturday. And of course, golf is back on CBS Friday and Saturday, 5 p.m. Eastern to 8 p.m. Eastern. So that will be very, very exciting stuff. But here we are, Sia. It's Torrey Pines. It's two courses, the North and the South. We got a taste of the course rotation last week, but this week it's just two of them and a 36-hole cut.
Yeah, this is certainly more palatable for me than last week. I don't really like the course rotation thing, but if it's going to be two as opposed to three, I'm totally down with it. I think this is going to be a much better indication of where golfers are at. Obviously, that South course is going to be a little bit more challenging than what we've seen the last few weeks. So I think this is a great test. A lot of great players have shown up. And it's one of those where, I don't think the Hudson Swaffords of the world, no disrespect to him, I don't think the Hudson Swaffords of the world are going to be there down the stretch, battling with the John Rahms.
Yeah, you can stretch this South course out pretty long here, Greg. And usually the defense around Torrey Pines is thick rough. It's that Kikuya kind of grab your club, mess with you type rough. And then when you get on these Poana greens, you're going to be doing a lot of guessing. It's going to look a little bit weird. This, the South course specifically, a fairly stout test.
Yes, and it's much less weather dependent than the courses we've seen so far. It's a seaside course, but it's not reliant on that. It's a brute all by itself any day of the year. Now, it'll have an effect, but it's not like its only defense is weather. The defenses are everywhere around this golf course. And so I expect to see a big change in not only style of players, as Sia said. I do think long shots have a chance. It's a certain type. And I also think you're going to see a much bigger separation between guys who are playing really well, guys who are struggling, which is, I couldn't agree more. I think it's a great test, a great examination of where players are with their game. And you see a really strong field as well. So it should be a good week.
Yeah, that's what I was excited about. So see, we've got a very strong field. It's changed the pricing. I'll pull up the cheat sheet on my website, rickrungood.com, here in just 1 second. But the pricing a little bit different. And how much are you going to consider the U.S. Open that we had at Torrey Pines last year? Because this is a rare opportunity. We played this course twice last year. We played it in end of January, the normal slot for the Farmers Insurance Open. Then in the summer, we used it for the U.S. Open. Will you be factoring both of those events into this week?
I don't think so. Honestly, I think you and Greg might be, certainly Greg might be a good arbiter of that as well. But a couple things that is just are sort of notable for me is it's obviously going to be different in January than it's going to be during the summertime with respect to run out and things of that nature, and just the air quality, things of that nature. So I think that's a little bit different. I think it would be more firm and fast at the U.S. Open. And also, I think the setup's a little bit different at the U.S. Open. So I'd rather just look at the Farmers track in terms of, you know, when the Farmers is played in the early part of the year.
All right.
Yeah. To add to that, weather is definitely a small difference. It's typically a little colder at the Farmers than it is at U.S. Opens. The golf course plays a little longer. Rough may be a little, it's probably similar. The par is different.
That's right.
But the biggest difference is, it's four rounds at the South course versus three rounds at the South course, which I also think is a really big difference. But I looked at this last year. A friend of mine and I were kind of discussing if the U.S. Open last year, although it was a great tournament, was it really a U.S. Open or was this a Farmers in June? And it was pretty close. The scoring averages were really close at the South course in January, the South course here. Now, the relation to par changed because they changed the par of the course. But it was actually quite similar. So I think the U.S. Open can have some effect. But also the fact that it's a major, I think it plays a role. And in my research and preparation for this event so far, I've noticed, looking at course history, a lot of the guys who have struggled at the Farmers put on pretty nice performances in June at the U.S. Open. But these are marquee players like Jordan Spieth, Brooks Koepka, guys who don't have great track records at the Farmers, Bryson DeChambeau, but they did at a U.S. Open. And I wonder if that's just because it's a major and their preparation changes, or if it has something to do with the style of play.
Well, let's dive headfirst into this field. Here is the cheat sheet, and I love this pricing. So there are six golfers, Sia, over $10,000 on DraftKings. Jon Rahm is 11,200. Justin Thomas is 10,900. Hideki Matsuyama, 10,600, with Dustin Johnson at 10,300. And the bottom of this range, Xander Schauffele is 10,100. And the respect on Daniel Berger's name, a flat $10,000. How do you start breaking down the top of the board?
Interesting that Berger reached that status above, like, the likes of, let's say, Bryson DeChambeau, for example. So, I always hate to say the best golfer in the world and be like, that's my guy. But it's really hard for me to ignore Jon Rahm. I don't think the pricing at 11,200 is prohibitive. I've built a lineup with John Rahm, and then I pulled somebody from the 9K range and went on my way down the line. And I was able to build a pretty strong lineup, in my opinion. Of course, in my opinion, 3 of 6 will make the cut. But the point is, I really love John Rahm for obvious reasons. He's going to rate out best in this field, no matter what model you're running. I think he's a great course fit, as you might expect. The other, and we're looking at his stuff now, Rick. I didn't know if you had something to say, but I have one other guy I kind of like in this.
Let me jump in on Rahm, because it's obviously impressive. And when you start looking at, history at Torrey Pines, and this will also include the U.S. Open. I mean, there's just nobody in this field, and really nobody on tour, who has the type of results that he does. He's gaining over 3 strokes per round in 24 rounds. When you start getting into that echelon of statistical production, that's what Tiger did for 10 years. Obviously, John Rahm's done it for 24 rounds, so it's a little bit different, but that's the type of domination that we're seeing here, Sia. So no surprise to see that he's the most expensive golfer, and likely that he will be one of the more popular guys in that 10K range.
Yeah, and another thing about him is the course history. I mean, you know, not everybody has great course history here, even in the elite range. Some of them have no course history. So you got a 7th, a 2nd, a 5th, 29th, and 1st over the last 5 times he's played the Farmers. So that's obviously super impressive. I'm going to go ahead and jam him in most of my lineups. Obviously, we'll monitor ownership percentage, but I don't see how I get away from him personally. The other guy I'm interested in here, I mean, I think DJ is interesting. We can get to him in a bit, but I think Hideki's interesting. I feel like we're at a point in his career where, I mean, the pricing is fine, but in terms of people's perception of him, I feel like he's the Paul Barjan of the 10K and above range, to be honest with you.
Do not,
like,
compare Hideki to Paul Barjan.
Do not compare these guys. He is the Rodney Dangerfield of this range. I feel like people just don't want to play him, and I think he'll be sandwiched among players that he's just going to be on the outside looking in from an ownership standpoint. I like his history here. His recent history isn't great, but his history overall is really good. He rates out, other than putting, which of course is an issue, he rates out really well in every category, including the long iron play, which I think will be critical here.
Which he has putted beautifully at Torrey Pines. He's gaining basically a 0.5 stroke per round. That's bonkers. He's got a really good history around here, and he gains DraftKings points to the field in 77% of his starts. That essentially means he scores more than the average. Greg, there is really a lot to dissect here when you're trying to go through the top players in the world at a world-class course. How do you view this $10,000 range? And you're on mute. Oh, what a rookie move.
First podcast. Happy to be here. I'm a little nervous. As I was saying, although nobody heard it, so now I have a chance to change what I was saying.
There's
a really disappointing aspect to the top of this range for me. Wow. And while there are a lot of players that I like, I have a hard time going away from Rahm. And last week just added fuel to the fire. And it almost, as he was getting so frustrated last week, it to me, it adds an element of drive for this week, heading into this tournament. And you know the setup's going to be different, and there's going to be no excuses. It's a opportunity for him to bounce back from what he feels like is a disappointing week, whether it's because of the setup or his own play or whatever his reasoning is. And his course history here is unbelievable. So I think this is the kind of event that he will figure out a way to win. I like the way that he drives the ball. This is famously a golf course where they always say, and this is a trap, you got to drive the ball in the fairway. It's an accuracy game. And it's not. What we've seen over the years is this is a scrambler's game. Guys who get up and down, guys who putt really well, are the guys that do really well here. And that's a John Rahm. Even a Tony Finau, right? He's got a great short game. So I lean heavy on short games around here. And Rahm's is as good as anybody's.
I'm glad you brought this up. I was running 2 different models earlier because I think there are 2 ways to kind of get it done around here. One is like be long and straight off the tee and try to make enough putts. The other is the Patrick Reed method, which is short game this place to death. The John Rahm's both. John Rahm's both of those guys.
Exactly.
He's got both paths to victory. It's actually It's actually quite crazy. As you can imagine, the 3.02 strokes he's gaining per round is that's the best course for him. He's gained more at Muirfield Village. He's gained more at Keene Trace, but he has less rounds there as well. So the rest of this 10K range, if it's not Rahm Sia, we talked about Hideki. Dustin Johnson seems to be a big question mark because we haven't seen him play in quite some time. Xander Schauffele, local kid who kind of exercised some demons around Torrey Pines in his last couple of trips. And then Daniel Berger, the curious $10,000 price tag on Daniel Berger. How about those guys at the bottom, Xander and Berger? How do those guys shape up for this week?
It seems like Berger would be the play for me, especially with the iron play. But, you know, the history here isn't great, although the last time he played here was 2019. I don't know that I want to hold that against him, given that he hasn't played the last couple of years. I don't know. Between those two, I don't think I'm going to play many of them much, but I'd probably go Xander. You mentioned exercising the demons. I mean, obviously, we always thought he should be good here, good on the West Coast. And he never kind of was. And then, you know, last year he kind of pulled through. So between those two, I think Berger might be higher owned, believe it or not. I think Xander might be the play for me.
Xander, he missed four of his first five cuts at Torrey Pines. And then he went runner up at the Farmers Insurance last year. He had a top 10 at the U.S. Open. So two top 10s in the same year. Greg, I love Daniel Berger, but I worry about him at Torrey Pines. I know that he had a top 10 at the U.S. Open, which is part of the reason that I love him. But this is a course to me that asks you to hit a lot of high draws. And that is like the total opposite of what Daniel Berger wants to do. And I wonder if that shot shape, not necessarily fitting his eye, is part of the reason he's not had great success at this course, or at this event, I should say.
There's kind of an interesting element to Daniel Berger that he sort of proved wrong for me last year, but I noticed this is a really strong correlation last year. When Berger got on big golf courses, he struggled. When he got on some of the shorter golf courses, you know, 7,300 and less, he would perform great. And it seemed like there was this clear correlation between distance and success. And if it was a big golf course, he struggled for the most part. On smaller golf courses, he did great. Now, I still think that's largely true with him, but he's definitely starting to show some ability. And what he did at the U.S. Open, he had a nice PGA championship last year too.
He had like three top tens in majors last year, didn't he? Or maybe I'm thinking of his WGC. Oh no, Open Championship, he finished eighth. U.S. Open, T7. Where was his PGA? Oh no, maybe I was thinking of a WGC. I thought he had a third.
What did he do at the? Oh, no, tied 75th. Yeah. There you go.
I think I was thinking of a WGC.
There you go. Tied 75th at the PGA. But that's an example of a big golf course that he struggles at. And so that's my big worry, is what he did at the U.S. Open, was that just a special week? Or does he do better on shorter golf courses? Century Tournament of Champions is long by numbers, but right. It's short. It's right. All wedges for everybody, even for Cam Smith. Hero World Challenge, not that long. He played pretty well there. Tour Championship, he's middle of the pack. Okay at BMW, not great. Then Memphis, he's the king of Memphis. He's the king tied of fifth, Memphis, yeah. Right? The Open, Royal St. George's, was not a long golf course. He's eighth there. The U.S. Open is the one that proves me, that kind of makes me wonder. But I still think there's enough there to worry about Berger, as good as he's been. And I think what Schauffele did last year makes a lot of sense. And it really makes you feel like, okay, he checks the box with the short game, although it hasn't been great of late. But I think he's an immensely talented short game player. I love what he does on the greens. He's very familiar with the golf course. And he seems to have lifted some kind of monkey off of his back. And what he does with his ball striking is elite. It's extremely good. So I would lean Schauffele over Berger here. But again, they're just in this. It's just clearly a different play. It's just, I'm not going to play Rahm, so I'll play blank. Right. I mean, Justin Thomas would be an option too. We haven't talked about him. He's been playing great. And And he also has a great short game. I worry about him putting a little bit on these greens. That's my biggest concern with him. But Justin Thomas is a factor. But are you going to play him over Rahm? It's hard for me to do that.
It would be hard. You want to hear something kind of crazy though?
Yeah.
So the best putting weeks ever for Justin Thomas, his best putting week as a professional on the tour, the 2014 Farmers. Okay. So little Torrey Pines love there. His five strokes that he gained at the US Open in 2021, that was obviously at Torrey Pines. That was like his eighth or ninth best putting week ever. Maybe he can figure these out. Maybe he's got some good vibes at Torrey.
Yeah, perhaps.
Or maybe it's
perhaps. Nice. I mean, I still just worry about it a little bit. And the US Open, you notice he finished tied 19th there with a great putting week. And that tells you he was struggling tee to green. But I love where he is right now. I love the last three finishes, even more than that. I love what he did through the playoffs. So he's been on a nice run here. And his game should fit Torrey Pines quite nicely. So I think JT would be another option. I guess if the best way to do it is probably rank them. Top three. And I'd go Rahm, Thomas, Schauffele.
What do you think, Sia?
I'm going Rahm, Decky, Dustin Johnson. I'll go with the unknown there.
I'll go Rahm, Xander, Dustin. I also think the unknown is kind of interesting. There is so much of a gap that Dustin Johnson can fill. Like if he just gets back to 70% of the ball striker that he was 12 months ago, the math problem is solved. He's such a good putter right now. It's actually quite ridiculous. Okay, let's go to the 9K range. There are so many good names in the 9K range. Bryson DeChambeau, Sam Burns, Brooks Koepka, Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth. Then we round it out with Sung Jae-im, Will Zalatoris, Tony Finau, and the man who won this 2 years ago, Mark Leishman. Sia, I'll bounce this right back to you. These names are usually much more expensive, and now we're getting an opportunity to get them in the 9,000s.
Yeah, I like a lot of names here. I think there's tremendous upside here. Sam Burns comes to mind, obviously. I mean, his recent history is just scorching. I like him quite a bit. Sungjae, I like. I just wonder if I'm going to get to him ultimately. I did run a model like I normally do, and he rated out really well for good reason. The ball striking is there. Strokes gained par five, which may be more important perhaps on the North course, but it's going to be important all the way around, of course. That's good. The long iron play is good. The around the green game play, which Greg just stressed is very important here. He's great there too, last 50 rounds. So I do like Sungjae. I like Zalatoris. I don't know if you guys recall, I was all over him last week. I love the unknown with him too. Yeah. And I thought the unknown would carry some lower ownership. I actually even had an outright on him, which almost got there. But the point is, the data we have from last week, he struck the ball really well. He lost a little bit with the putter, which isn't entirely unexpected. But I think Zalatoris is an interesting got to go back with, because I don't think he's going to carry a lot of ownership again. I do think he's a little risky compared to some of the elite names on this list, but I definitely like him. Another 9K guy just to bring up is Mark Leishman. Obviously, the history here with Mark Leishman is very, very good. Mm-hmm. Hard for me to just ignore that. And so if there was a course I was going to kind of go all in on with Mark Leishman, which is not something I'd ever thought I'd say, it would be this one.
Well, Will Zalatoris did indeed gain a stroke and a half off the tee, 3.5 on approach. That was only in the two measured rounds that he had at the stadium course. He was pretty darn good last week. Sam Burns, I will remind everyone, the T18 that he had at this event last year, not really indicative of his actual play at this event. He was in the final group with Patrick Reed. He immediately four-putted the first green and never recovered. One of his worst putting rounds of his career kind of played him out of it. So that T18 or whatever it ended up being looks a lot worse than it actually was. So Greg, I'll bounce this over to you. We haven't said Bryson DeChambeau's name yet. We haven't said Brooks Koepka's name yet. We haven't said Jordan Spieth's name yet. What are we doing in the nines?
As Kyle Porter would say, Brooks and Brooksy. Both those guys are fades for me.
Okay.
Brooks just hasn't proved it to me yet. I'm very interested this year to see if the fact that he's on the Player Advisory Council now and some of his comments. He mentioned last year how he had two top 25 finishes outside of majors, and he said that's just not good enough. And that's a very different, and then he joins Player Advisory Council. And those two things speak a very different language than I only practice for majors. So I'm I've always had this thought that Koepka's success mirrors his effort. And when he's focused, he has success. And when he doesn't care or he's not practicing leading in, he doesn't have success. So it's very simple. But I haven't seen enough proof of that lately. So I'm fading Koepka for that reason. With Bryson, I don't love this golf course for him. I know he had the lead on Sunday at Torrey Pines. It hasn't been great at the Farmers. And the big worry for me, again, I think short game's so important here. That's what I see when I look at the winning trends here. I see short game. It's a huge area of weakness for Bryson. I think this year on tour, and I know it's a short, he's outside the top 200. It's, and his scrambling numbers aren't great either. So it's a big worry for me. I think you're going to miss greens out here, even the best ball strikers. So for that reason, I fade him. Jordan Spieth, big question marks for me. I love the fingerprint, and he would be the guy of this group I'd take a chance on. I'd take a flyer on, but I have my reservations because
his path to winning is much more reminiscent of Patrick Reed's path to winning this event, isn't it?
Right. Right. But I think Jordan has shown some really nice driver swings. When I was watching him at the, I think it was at Hero. It might've been at Century. It was at Century. There were a lot of really smooth looking swings with the driver. Now he didn't get much out of it. He didn't get anything out of his rounds, but I got a sense that he was feeling pretty good. I think it's interesting that he would make swing changes this offseason, but he seemed to be very, very optimistic about them. He said that he was feeling better than he did at any point last year, which is a really big statement. And I'm wondering if this is the week when he shakes the rust off. That's a huge hit or miss play. So the guys that I love in this range would be Burns. It would be, I would lean Finau and Leishman.
Let's talk Finau. Yeah, Finau here. So, you know, you can debate the recent form. T40 at the American Express, T19 at the Tournament of Champions, T7 at the Hero. Obviously, the TOC and the Hero are very, very small field events. But when Tony Finau shows up at the Farmers, he finds it. And he finds it in a big way. Last 5 years, he has 4 top 6 finishes, Sia. This is literally, I'm not exaggerating, the course that he putts better on than any other course he ever plays on the PGA Tour. This has been the spot. Maybe it's volatility, maybe it's variance, maybe these are outlier weeks, but we're starting to get a lot of rounds where he's putting well to continue to call them outliers.
You guys are going to make me go back to Tony Finau. Is that what's happening right now? So, I mean, I get it. It is a good argument.
Okay, this is the best setup for Tony in some, like resort golf for Tony Finau does not get me excited.
Yeah.
Golf courses that he can kind of lean on the driver and he can take, increase the gap between himself and the field off the tee. Those are courses that I like Tony Finau. His around the green game, sharp. If he can putt like anywhere close to what he's done in his career, at Torrey Pines this week, that is super, super dangerous. He's got like 3 of the 4 puzzle pieces hovering all around each other to put this together.
So my DFS teams last week were anchored by Zalatoris and Tony Finau. And of course, I was a little disappointed at Tony Finau. And I wish you had given me this speech last week because I would have saved him for this week. No, it's really compelling. I hadn't, and this is, you know, of course, you have recency bias. So Tony Finau was kind of a name I just kind of scanned over. But I'm definitely leaning on course history this week. And so that is really, really compelling. I'm definitely going to have to factor him in. The problem really is that the 9K range is so rich, but I'm convinced. I mean, I'm definitely going to have a few shares of Tony Finau.
And look, this is also, it's like another start to the season, right? It's our fourth, third or fourth so far. And this is the start of the CBS broadcast crew. And it's the start of the real... I know the American Express is part of the West Coast swing, But this is a different, this is where the big boy golf courses start. And you start to see a little difference in weather and setups and the scoring benefits a player like Finau. I completely agree, Rick. A birdie fest, you heard John Rahm call it a putting contest, whether that's right or wrong, that kind of atmosphere isn't great for Finau. This one, he can make pars. He can grind a little bit. He can take advantage of par fives. He can, you got some 600 plus yard par fives that actually play that long. Because it's some thick air. It plays long out here. And that's a big advantage for Finau because he can hit it really high. He can use his driver, as Rick alluded to. He can reach par fives that other players won't be able to reach. And that's a huge separator. And his short game is way underrated, in my opinion. Right. There's this funny thing, guys who can't putt, we think their short game stinks too.
Yes.
Hideki Matsuyama is a great example. I mean, he has an elite short game, but he can't putt. So you look at it, it has a different, you have a different opinion on it. But I love Finau this week. And I think at 9,100, you know, you got Leishman right there too, but at 9,100, he could be a really nice fit.
Okay, we're going to move on to the $8,000 range. We'll find some value in this field. But first, we're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our partners.
Let's go!
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount+. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
The baseball season is in full swing, which means you need to listen to Fantasy Baseball Today, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Scott White, Chris Towers, and me, Frank Stample, every weekday as we recap every player from every game. We'll talk waiver wire ads, drops, players to trade for, prospects who could make an impact, and everything in between. Make sure to download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and everywhere else podcasts are found.
And we're back. Let's go on to that $8,000 range. A couple of guys at the top who disappointed last week. Corey Connors, Taylor Gooch, Matthew Wolf, all at the top of this $8,000 range, along with our defending champion, Patrick Reed. Then the bottom half of the $8,000 range, see ya, it's Max Homa, it's Christian Bezuidenhout, it's Maverick McNealy, and it's Ryan Palmer. This is a fascinating, tiny little $8,000 range that I have no idea what to do with.
Yeah, you know, I don't think we would have anticipated Ryan Palmer being in the same range as Corey Connors and Taylor Gooch. I think that's super interesting. And there's good reason, by the way. Listen, before I was president of the Hank Lebiota fan club, I was president of the Ryan Palmer fan club, if you guys remember, early last year. So I'll get to Ryan Palmer in a second. But the few guys that I like here, Taylor Gooch, I think I like quite a bit. Speaking of guys who have a really good short game, I mean, Taylor Gooch definitely rates out really well there. But just overall, I don't think there's anything, you know, off the tee, Taylor Gooch certainly isn't elite, but everything else he does pretty well. So I'm definitely in on Taylor Gooch. I do like the recent play in spite of last week. I like Mav McNealy a little bit, not a ton, but I'm definitely going to be playing a little bit of Mav McNealy. And then I'll go to Ryan Palmer, the recent history, or I shouldn't say recent. Actually, the recent history really is good for Ryan Palmer. I think that might surprise some people, but the course history is, I mean, you brought up Tony Finau. It's not that good, but the course history here is really, really compelling for Ryan Palmer. So it makes sense that he's actually in this range, and I think I'm going to bite.
Yeah, the course history for Ryan Palmer, actually only second to John Rahm in this field. Now, that dates back to 2010. He hasn't played this event every single year, but he's got a couple of runner-up finishes. This also includes his miscut at the U.S. Open, but he gained 4 strokes tee to green that week. Ryan Palmer, this is probably a pretty decent spot to run him out, and he's played well enough here recently. Is this an opportunity, Greg, to forgive Corey Connors? Is it an opportunity to forgive Matthew Wolf? Or are we just going to avoid these guys and wait to see them play a little bit better?
Just thinking about lineup construction, I'm not sure that Corey Connors is a great option. Although I completely forgive him for last week. I don't hold anything against him. I worry about his short. He's not one of those guys where the ball striking and the lack of putting masks a good short game. He doesn't have a great short game. He hasn't really gained strokes around the green a lot very often. So that is the one thing that kind of holds me back. It's not last week's performance. You miss the cut at the American Express. It happens. It's such a unique event, and it doesn't mean that this is going to be a bad week for you. So I completely forgive him, but I could go that way, but it's not really my favorite. My favorite play in this range is, believe it or not, Max Homa.
Yeah. Okay.
He has some nice finishes here. His last two starts are a T9 and a T18. And I think he's really starting to get a flavor, get really comfortable playing in California. Poa does really well for him. And I like what he's done with the ball striking. I know recently it hasn't been extremely exciting. And I know the short game's a weakness too, but I have a sense with Max Homa that the California thing is starting to really become a thing. And I'm willing to take a chance on that more so than, and other than that, I guess you could play, I'd be comfortable playing Corey Connors or Max Homa. But I don't know how much I'm going to actually play in this range.
Yeah, Homa has played well. I mean, his wins at Quail Hollow and Riviera, obviously more difficult golf courses, and he can hang a bit. Here's a little lesson in strokes gained around the green, and it's Corey Connors is a perfect example of this. What you'll notice is the best around the green weeks for Corey Connors are his worst approach weeks, which makes complete sense. Because around the green, that's a counting stat. It's a stat that if you're hitting every single green, you don't have to lean into. So it's hard to kind of rely on that, especially because you'd be preferring that your golfer not have to tap into his around the green play.
I just have one question on that, Rick, because I completely agree. Because it's cumulative, mm-hmm. It affects the averages. So when it comes to how much you gain, you don't want to be gaining a ton around the green.
Right.
But does it go the other way when you're losing? You understand what to me, there's a little bit of a tipping point here.
No, it doesn't go the other way when you're losing, right? Because the idea would be so if you are missing greens and piling up a bunch of strokes around the green because you're chipping so often and you're chipping better than tour average, that's kind of not great. But if you're losing strokes, but you're hitting a lot of greens, it could be around the green should not be a per round thing. It should be a per shot thing. That would level this a lot better. Cause you might have guys over the course of a week that have 12 chips and you might have guys that have 36 chips. Like it's
right.
It should be per shot. It's really hard to bear out on a per round basis.
Yeah. I'm good with that. I'm good. Do you like looking at a scrambling number more?
Yes and no. There's flaws with scrambling as well, but I think you need to look at a more complete profile of scrambling and then strokes gained around the green, or if you want to do strokes gained kind of short game and include putting in there as well. You need a bigger picture for the short game stuff because of not how different it is for every single player in the field.
Right. That's a really good lesson. It's an important thing to learn. You can't just jump. And I typically look at around the green and scrambling combined. And if one of those are good, and eye test, right? When you watch a player, because the other thing about short game that is probably, we've talked about this with approach play. If Jordan Spieth hits it in the woods and is escaping, is his approach, his strokes gain approach number inflated because his opportunity was reduced from the tee.
He still has to hit the good shot, but by being so wayward off the tee, he is giving himself an opportunity to gain more strokes on approach. Now he is taking that opportunity and he is hitting great shots from terrible positions, but there is a larger amount of strokes that he can gain because he's so off.
Right. And is it setting up birdies? So now when you go to around the green play, and I know this doesn't do you any good in telling you who to line up. It's just, it's important in these short game weeks. Are you losing strokes around the green because you're short siding yourself?
Right.
If you're a Corey Connors, you're confident with your ball striking and you're hitting at a lot more flags. Are you short siding yourself more often? And now the distance is the distance and the lie is what determines the difficult, the stroke average, right? You're 20 yards in the rough or 15 yards in the rough, but it doesn't say, well, below the hole, above the hole.
Right.
So it doesn't really take that into account. No green to work with, no green to work with. It's the most complicated of the strokes gain stats, in my opinion, but I use that in concert with scrambling for sure.
Yeah. Well, one of the better scramblers or short game, no matter how you look at it, is Patrick Reed. See, if I forced you to play, you have to play either Patrick Reed,
the other guy.
Oh boy. Oh, let me scroll down the list. I was going to say Patrick Reed at 8,700 or Matthew Wolf at 8,500, but you have already planted.
Hold on. Patrick Reed is my answer. Wow. That might've been like the one guy you could have said that I was, but Matthew will actually, you know, Matthew Wolf is not a, I got to take a second look at Matthew Wolf. It's still Patrick Reed.
Play Patrick Reed than Matthew Wolf.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have real worries about Reed.
So do I.
And I wouldn't be friends with you if you forced me to pick between those two.
Yeah,
but I think devious. I would take Wolf because there's just more unknown. With Reed, there's a lot of known. I mean, look at that. That upper left is, yeah. That is so problematic. The signs are so clear.
Yes.
That he is struggling with his swing. Now, I think he's actually making swing changes, and I think it's going to improve over time, but I haven't seen anything like that yet. And I've been harping on how important short game is this week, but you have to be able to control your ball to some degree. This is short game because when you hit good shots, they don't always hit the green. They don't always hit the fairway. You're forced to scramble a little bit. But when you are hitting it the way Patrick Reed has been, it makes for a long week.
The only counter I'll give there, and it might not be a good one, is the course history is so good that if he were to find his game to any degree, you would think it would be, even though he doesn't necessarily seem like a great course fit, you'd think it would be here.
You'd think. I mean, Wolf said he had one bad week. He was awesome in the fall, and he might, if he finds it and he, you know, that model of club head speed through thick rough is a good one. And if you force me to pick one, I'm not like super thrilled about either, but I think you, Matthew Wolf would be my guy. The $7,000 range seal. We'll start with you. I'm not going to read all the names, but Justin Rose, Keegan Bradley, Billy Horschel, and Siwoo Kim are at the top. And it goes down to, let's see, Lee Hodges, Doug Gim, Phil Mickelson, Sebastian Munoz. Is there anyone in this $7,000 range that you would be comfortable clicking their name?
There's a few guys I've kind of gone back and forth on, but the three that I've sort of honed in on, really two and a half, I want to get your opinion on the third one. Aaron Wise is one. I think there's a lot of volatility with Aaron Wise, but I think the upside is definitely there. So he's definitely going to fit into my lineups. I mean, the stats bear out that he should be finished. His finishing positions should be higher than what they are. I will say this, the long iron play, you know, if you go back the last 36, 50 rounds, it's certainly not elite. So that's just, you know, you're going to need the proximities here are, you know, 175 and above, 200 and above. That's just going to be a thing. So you got to be at least okay there. And I think he probably will be. Everything else seems to be pretty good, including that short game, that around the green game that we were talking about. So I think Aaron Wise, go ahead.
I couldn't be more bullish on Aaron Wise for the next 25 events. I'm not sure. I don't know about this week. We're going to find out. And he is doing a transformation with the putter that it's kind of even hard to look at some of his last like 12 months worth of stuff, because if he's different now, he's a lot better at a lot of different places. So I'm like the next 25 events, very bullish on Aaron Wise. We'll see how it bears out.
Yeah. And you might be looking at his course. Some people might be looking at his course history, but just keep in mind, he hasn't played here in the last 2 years, and Aaron Wise of 3 years ago was not the Aaron Wise of today. So just one thing to keep in mind when it comes to course history. Luke List is another guy that, you know, obviously the putter is a concern, but he's got great finishing positions here. I believe he is a better putter here on this green than he is at other places. And the around the green game again is pretty great. And the ball striking is great.
Yeah, he's much better on POA. He's about half as bad as he is on other surfaces, which still a negative. But if you're Luke List, losing a quarter of a stroke per round with the putter is a huge win from tee to green. He's phenomenal. He's been phenomenal for a long time. The results are there as well. Was there a third guy, Sia?
Yeah, so this is the one I wanted to ask you both about, Keith Mitchell. So if you just look at the very recent form in terms of his approach play and his putter, it looks like there might be a turnaround in progress, but it also could just be a blip on the radar. If it is a turnaround in progress, I think Keith Mitchell might be in a similar conversation of some of the other guys we've talked about over the last few weeks, where he's starting to vault up pricing, vault up leaderboards, and we're just in the middle of witnessing it.
So Keith Mitchell is a guy on my list. I really like him this week. He's a great driver of the ball. And what I, the reason I like him, I think there's something real going on here. I think he's made some effort to really kind of lose that I'm a popper mindset. So I heard this interview. He was on a show on Sirius, on PGA Tour Radio. And he was talking about his strategy with his iron play, which if you think about what this guy's done, he's popped up at certain events every once in a while and really contends, nearly contends. He seems to always drive it well. When he pops up, he has these good iron weeks. But the thing that he's done is he's taken a much more conservative approach with irons. And he's gone into some data and some research and when, much like Stuart Sink, right? When do you attack? When don't you attack? Where should I really aim versus what's my perception of where I should aim? And as he's gotten a little more, this is new. This is all very new for him. But as he's gotten a little more conservative with his iron game, I'm wondering if he's going to start to become much more consistent with his finishes. So based on what I heard and what I see on the results, expecting that to change, I think this could be a really, really advantageous for him. And I think he could be kind of a sneaky play. So I love Keith Mitchell this week.
Interesting. I'm intrigued. I mean, the numbers are probably better than I would have imagined when I pulled them up here. So I'm intrigued by that, Sia. Okay. Greg, let's open up the $7,000 range to you. Could I offer you... oh, I don't know, Francesco Molinari. Could I offer you Mito Pereira? Or would you like to offer up your own $7,000 options?
I'll offer my own. Okay, you can offer me whoever you want. I mean, Francesco is really interesting, I'll say that. Still some question marks for me. I don't think American Express alone is a good enough sample size to gauge someone's form at an event like this. If it was combined with, you know, RSN, a couple other weeks in there, I'd have a better feel. But Lonto Griffin is a guy that really stands out to me. And I'll tell you why. Lonto, the big concern with me for Lonto was short game. And if you go back to the match play last year, he was playing really well. And this is the kind of an event that he does really well at. It's a hard golf course, requires some good ball striking and short. You don't have to make a ton of birdies and fill it up that way. But so he had some really nice steady form. You know, you could see all that. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see all the top 25s in a row and it's steady play. And he gets to the match play. He gets to the 18th hole in one of the matches.
Did his brain malfunction in that moment?
Well, I think it could have. I think his short game technique malfunctioned because you remember clearly. He flubs one and then blades one over the green.
Yeah.
And back to back. And it was a disaster. And look at what happened since. I mean, all of a sudden, this guy that's Mr. Consistent and Mr. Steady is struggling to make cuts. And I'm convinced that is when short game gets in your head, the game gets really hard because now there's more pressure off the tee, there's more pressure on your approach game. There's more pressure on your putting. You feel like you have to, it just becomes disastrous and you can't hide from it. He's figured something out. I'm not sure what it is, but I believe he's figured something out around the green. And you just started to see things kind of get a little better. And then it got a little worse and they got a little better, a little worse, a little better. And all of a sudden, I think you're going to see this player come back into his own form. I'm not saying he's going to finish tied third again. But I think the guy that we're used to seeing top 25, T19, T16, T27, that guy, I think, is coming back.
He has three top seven finishes in his last five starts, Greg, and the advanced metrics look a lot like the time period that you were referencing prior to the match play.
Yeah, and so I think that period is a clear hinge point. And what I see in the numbers, I haven't heard him talk about it at all, but what I see in the numbers is the guy that figured that out. So I'm really optimistic on Lonto, and I love a Keith Mitchell in this range as well.
I'll offer up a little bit of Patrick Rogers. Very good POA putter, drives it well, has a couple of top tens at this event. I think you guys grabbed the other ones that I liked. I don't think I have. And Mito's back. I'm just excited to see what Mito does. He's $7,400. I'm interested to see.
Where's he been?
Probably relaxing, man. I don't know. He's been chilling.
Yeah.
That's not his car. I mean, he's chilling.
I guess so. And hey, he earned it.
Yeah.
That's a long time off.
Yeah, he hasn't played since RSM.
Yeah. And for a guy that's that young, that worries me a little bit. Because I don't know if that's just strategy. Could that be, is there something else going on? Maybe, I don't know. That makes me really, my ears perk up when I see that. I don't know why he would do that.
I don't know. He was playing a practice round with Joaquin Neiman on Monday at Torrey Pines. I have no idea. I don't know what he's up to. We'll see. $6,000 range, Siya Najab.
Yeah, this one's tough. I had a list of like five or six names, and I just slowly started crossing them off. So I still have a couple names, and believe it or not, and I'm not even joking.
Don't say Kyle Stanley.
Kyle Stanley.
I know. I can read this guy's mind.
It's Kyle Stanley. Wow, that was pretty good, because you could have gone, Hank Lebiota's in there. There's Paul Barjon. There's plenty of guys.
I knew it because Stanley's played well here before, hasn't he, Greg? Greg, remember,
yes.
This is the moment, right? This is the moment we always talk about.
Right.
A couple times.
A couple times. But he blew a three-shot lead here.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like the next Tiger Woods when he came to the 18th hole with a three-shot lead.
Yeah.
And, well, he did go – he came back and won Waste Management. So that was an elite comeback, but it was devastating. But yeah, he's done well here.
Yeah, that's how I knew Siya, because I knew he had that high finish, and I knew that was the thing that clicked in my brain that it was going to be Kyle Stanley.
So yeah, three out of five cuts over the last five he's made. One was an 18th, one was a 14th. And then at the Sony, he finished 27th. So as usual, the putter fails him. The around the green game isn't much better. But given that he has some good history here and that he's such an elite ball striker. So here's the thing. We always sort of talk, we pepper this in sometimes where it's like, I'll take the elite ball striker and hope the putter pops. Well, in Kyle Stanley's case, we're just taking the elite ball striking, right? The putter never actually pops. But to me, if you were going to have a place to play Kyle Stanley, it would probably be in a place where he's actually finished pretty well. The ball striking remains elite. It's not like that's tailed off. He's got to be in the top 10 ball striking. I mean, it's obnoxiously good.
He would be, when you go to the simulator and they put the ring at like 25 feet and that's like an automatic two putt. And then they put the ring at 6 feet and that's like an automatic one putt. If that was professional golf, he'd be the best player in the world. Like that's, he just peppers it. But then, he has to put the ball in the cup, and that's where things go awry.
Fair enough. And the only other guy I want to mention is Emiliano Grillo. I don't want to say he's mispriced, but I think he's a pretty good course fit here. And speaking of bad putter, okay, yeah,
he I was going to say he'd putter. Be the second best player in the world at this simulator golf.
However, you'll notice that the putter hasn't been bad lately. Look at that. The last four out of the last five rounds, he's either gained with the putter or very minimally lost. So, yeah, there's a stretch there where it's just horrific with the putter. But again, we're looking for trends. We want to be on the front end of trends. Given his typical ball striking, it hasn't been elite lately, but given his typical ball striking, I think he's a really nice value in this range.
All right. Kyle Stanley, Emiliano Grillo, a couple of hashtag team no putters for Siya Najab. So, Greg, what can you find me in this $6,000 range that might be of value?
I'm kind of curious about your boy, Rick, your boy, Adam Long?
Adam Long.
Right. I saw him down here. He's 6,800. I got lost on.
Yeah, he's 6,800.
I'm not as well versed navigating your site as you
are. Well, I would hope not. It's not called gregrungood.com.
Yeah.
I would hope that I'm better at navigating it.
And it shouldn't be. Yeah, but he's 6,800. So your streak, your favorite stat is still alive.
Still alive, baby.
And you look at Sony and American Express. I'm not too worried about that. Those missed cuts, they don't really worry me too much. So based on that, if Adam Long makes the cut, he's going to pay for himself. Mm. And that's all we need. So I'm interested in that. The results haven't been great. I do feel like Patton Kizzire is starting to play a little bit better. He's definitely hitting the ball better. And
last week, that was worth a bunch of points.
Yeah. So I think he's not a great short gamer, but he has weeks where he is. So I think Patton Kizzire could be a play, although I don't love it. And then the last guy who is a complete flyer, but I'm wondering if this is the kind of an event. This is probably just I'll just say it, but Taylor Pendrith. And the reason I say him is he's long.
He's
really
long.
Yeah. And he played really well in Bermuda, which was the last time and the only time I've ever even come close to thinking about playing him. And so he's on my good side. And I like his distance. And he has done pretty well in he's been a good putter before, although the last two of the last 3 weeks have been weak. So
Pendrith would be like the Bramlett pivot. Joseph Bramlett at 6,700 is going to be pretty popular. He bombs the absolute guts out of the ball. He finished top 20 here last year. He's made two cuts at this event. He was near the top of the leaderboard for two rounds last week, and he's made both cuts to start his 2022. So he's going to be popular in a range where it is really hard to find guys. Pendrith would be like the kind of similar-ish pivot in that range that nobody's going to play.
Right. Go ahead.
Can I offer you two other guys? I really just want to get your opinion on them. One is a newcomer. Speaking of Pendrith, it's Adam Svensson.
Yeah.
And the other one is Jason Duffner. I mean, I'll start with Jason Duffner while you're kind of looking stuff up, but the ball striking for Duffner is really good. The short game tends to be good. Or at least it has been lately. The putter's up and down. I mean, listen, it's the upside. You know, he's not going to win the tournament, but 6,400.
What is his upside? T23 in this field? Like, does that feel like the ceiling for Duffner?
Yes, actually.
And you'd probably take it, right? First, what is he? 6,000. How much does he cost?
6,400.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. You definitely take
I think that's a good, pretty good play.
The putter's been better recently.
Is this similar to what we saw with, I don't know if the fact that he's putting better is a good thing.
Because you're talking about, of course it is.
Well, of course, yeah, but the results, it hasn't yielded great results. That's what I mean. If we saw those results, putting was really weak, ball striking was carrying him that far, I'd say, oh, that's great.
Yeah,
this is the thing I felt about Hudson Swafford, who I actually, after this episode, I started to really like when I looked at him. But his ball striking had been great of late, and he's just waiting on this putter. And when I found out that put a new putter in play, I was really intrigued. And I love this history at American Express. And it's that one hinge point. Like he's feeling good and he's getting better with his ball striking. Something's changed. And he's just waiting on the putter for results. That's what happened with Swafford. I almost see that with Duffner. But the better putting hasn't yielded. He gained 2.6 strokes at the American Express. It led to T40. He gained strokes in Houston and missed the cut. So you understand what I'm saying, Rick?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do understand what you're saying. And I wish I had an answer for it. I mean, it's like a little bit better than Kyle Stanley. When Kyle Stanley putts well, it's just like a 41st place finish. Duffner gets you to 23rd, and it's like, okay, whatever. We'll end on this because there is a pretty decent question in the chat here, Sia. I'll just shorten it. How do you factor ownership into your decision-making process, when to go contrarian or when to pick a highly owned guy to keep pace with everyone else? That's from Jerron. So thank you very much for the question.
Well, to me, you're never rostering a highly owned guy just to keep pace with everyone else. I think in a cash setup, that's something you want to consider. It's okay to play quote chalky guys in a cash game. But in, you know, to me with golf, especially because there's so much variance, even with the elite guys, you want to play the guys that you really like, guys that you really think are going to do well. And if they happen to be very popular, I think that's generally okay, as long as all the way down the board, you're not playing super popular guys. So if John Rahm, for example, if you're like, this guy's going to win, John Rahm's going to win. If you're convinced that he's going to win or top five or whatever it is, top three, then roster him if he's 25%. But there are some cases like two weeks ago, Webb Simpson, and this is an example I know Andy Lack gave when he took down the PME. Webb Simpson was super popular, but it was Hideki Matsuyama that he ended up going with because he was 1/5 the ownership of Webb. So there are certain guys, like even for me, I faded Webb that week because he was too high. I wasn't convinced that he was going to win the tournament, but it's okay to take a chalky guy if you actually think they are going to do really, really well.
The alternative to being contrarian is being unique, and ways that you can be unique are different builds, meaning two $10,000 guys and a bunch of 6K guys, or, you know, a more balanced build, or starting with two guys that you know aren't going to be the popular ones, or leaving $500 or $1,000 on the table. You could have six 20% owned guys, but if you leave $1,000 on the table, you are likely to be unique and likely to be different. Do you want to know how much the optimal lineup would have cost last week if you played it?
4,300.
43,000.
4,300.
Yeah.
I saw your tweet. I cheated and still got it wrong.
Oh,
you know, yes. The one thing I'd add to that, Rick, the tip of going away under the 50K salary cap is brilliant. Keeps you different. But you have to see his point. If you look at betting odds, this has always stuck out to me. If you're playing odds, the odds only matter if you win. If you lose, it's wrong. So the key is pick the guys that you think are going to do well. And if you really like them, then play them. And so I have a tendency of leaning a little more chalky. I like to have reasons for my picks. But the Rick strategy of the different builds has really helped me personally. And that's kind of my way around that, where I can still go with my safe guys and chalky guys. So I feel like I'm in the mix on the weekend, but you do end up quite different that way.
Yeah, the betting odds is a good point. If you want to be a little bit different and you want to leave a little money on the table, you know the difference between a 40-1 guy winning the tournament and a 50-1 guy winning the tournament? One is going to win it 2.5% of the time. The other one's going to win it 2% of the time. You're not giving up that much to drop a little bit further, especially in our game of golf. Gentlemen, I think that's going to do it for the DFS preview for this week's Farmers Insurance Open. I will thank myself as the producer of this show and hope that producer Jacob is having safe travels down to the PGA show. Sia Nejad can be found on Twitter at Sia Nejad. Greg Ducharme can be found at The Real GFD. And you can find me at Rick Run Good. This has been The First Cut, and we'll catch you next time.
Hello, everyone. It's Michael Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.